within the civilian population. And I think what's missing is that type of context, the understanding of what pumping all of this money into the security apparatus in the Sahel has meant for the people there.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. I thank you both so much for being with us, and we'll continue to follow things closely there in Niger. Nick Terse, investigative journalist, contributing writer for The Intercept. We will link to your recent pieces. Niger coup leader joins long line of U.S.-trained mutineers, as well as soldiers mutiny in U.S.-allied Niger. And Olayinka Ajala, we thank you so much for being with us from Glasgow, senior lecturer in politics and international relations from Leeds Beckett University. And we will link to your piece, What Caused the Coup in Niger, in Expert Outlines 3, Driving Factors. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
KABU Community Radio is hiring a full-time development director. This position leads all fundraising campaigns in alignment with KABU's mission, goals, and policies. The development director works closely with management and staff to identify funding priorities and create major donor campaigns, capital campaigns, and grant writing. More info can be found at kabu.fm/hiring. We will begin reviewing applications on August 7th, and the position will remain open until filled. KABU is an equal opportunity employer.
This is KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, Governor Tina Kotek signs the law allowing self-serve gas in Oregon to start today.
The EPA has approved boat fuel that poses an extremely high cancer risk.
And in national news, the Tennessee legislators expelled over their gun control protest win back their seats.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, August 4th, 2023. I'm Ray Bodwell.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. If your weekend plans and driving somewhere nice in this beautiful summer weather, you could be filling up your own gas tank in Oregon. Governor Tina Kotek signed a new state law that goes into effect today that allows for drivers to pump their own gas. Before this law, Oregon was one of two states in the nation that required gas to be pumped by an attendant. Attendants pumped gas. That's not going away, though. The law says that gas stations can set aside half of the pumps for full-service gas by attendants. It also makes it so gas stations cannot charge a different price for self-service or full-service. The law does require that gas stations that are open late still have an attendant available in urban counties. Gas pumps can stay on overnight without an attendant in rural counties. Lawmakers have been inching towards this for some time, passing laws in 2015 and 2017 to extend self-service gas in rural areas in hours when it's not really practical to have an attendant on site. Opponents fear that self-service gas will mean a loss in jobs and that it will make it more difficult for people with disabilities. Gas station owners say they've had trouble keeping their attendant positions filled anyway, so the reduction in needed staff is actually welcome. Some supporters of the law, however, see it as an equity issue. There are gas fumes that people are exposed to when pumping gas that are bad for their health. Someone pumping their gas once every week or two will have much lower exposure than someone who works at the pump 8 hours a day. Gas stations don't have to offer self-service if they don't want to. It's up to the owner if they want to keep their station as an attendant service only.
92% of employees for Powell City of Books say they're ready to go on strike if necessary, according to a recent union vote. Powell's is one of Portland's biggest attractions, but workers there say they're underpaid and making poverty wages. The strike authorization vote comes after months of contract negotiations between management and members of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, or ILWU Local 5, Powell's labor union. Earlier this week, 92% of Powell's workers who voted agreed to authorize a strike. Their contract expired June 7th. That doesn't mean workers are immediately on strike, but rather that the union bargaining team can call for a strike if they deem it necessary to do so. ILWU Local 5 made a statement on Twitter today writing, quote, "While we hope the company will accept that invitation and bargain in good faith, this vote signals that PAL's workers are prepared to respond accordingly if they don't," end quote. Instead of a boycott, union members are asking supporters to donate to their local strike fund, which they say will help keep workers afloat in case of a labor strike. Union Representative Micah Dubay told the Mercury that PAL's management is expected to come back to the bargaining table with their next offer at the end of August. PAL's issued a statement saying their latest proposal includes immediate wage increases and upholds excellent health care benefits. Dubay said workers and management are close to an agreement on expanded health care coverage, but there's still a gap when it comes to acceptable pay. She said, quote, "We want to see a range where people can be a bookseller at PAL's and earn more than $20 an hour. Most of the workers you'll see in the store cap out at $19 an hour. That's just not affordable or sustainable for people to be able to live in Portland or even near Portland and work at PAL's," end quote.
The Environmental Protection Agency has given the okay to a boat fuel ingredient with an extraordinarily high lifetime cancer risk. Reporting from ProPublica and The Guardian revealed that the EPA's scientists' risk assessment was far higher than what was published. It's 1.3 in 1. That means every person exposed to it over the course of a full lifetime would be expected to get cancer. Even so, the EPA decided that its scientists overstated the cancer risk and gave Chevron the okay to produce the chemical. KBOO's Grant Button has more.
The Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA, approved a component of boat fuel that is made from discarded plastic, despite the agency determining that it is extremely hazardous. It was approved under a program meant to help the climate by finding alternatives to petroleum-based fuels. The EPA's job is to review the safety of new chemical products, and if the chemical causes unreasonable risk to health or the environment, they are not allowed to approve it. However, Chevron's new boat fuel ingredient was approved by the EPA despite shocking data from its scientists. In fact, the scientists found that every person exposed to the substance continually over a lifetime is expected to get cancer. This danger is a million times higher than what the EPA usually considers acceptable, and higher than the risk of getting lung cancer from a lifetime of smoking. The chemicals can poison air and contaminate water, and yet the EPA only mandated workers to wear gloves. 7 out of every 100 people who eat fish raised in contaminated water by this chemical are expected to get cancer. The EPA acknowledged that they made multiple mistakes with the consent order, including not mentioning the enormous risks of the chemical and mislabeling critical information. This is the second extremely hazardous chemical approved by the EPA for Chevron. A waste plastic jet fuel was also approved, predicted to cause cancer in 1 in every 4 people. Maria Doa is a scientist who worked for the EPA for 30 years and once directed the division that managed the risk posed by chemicals. When she first saw the 1 in 4 cancer risk for the jet fuel, she thought it was a typo and couldn't believe it when she saw the even higher cancer risk associated with the boat fuel. She said, quote, "I had never seen a 1 in 4 risk before this, let alone 1.3 in 1. This is ridiculously high," end quote. Both of the two cancer-causing products are expected to be used at 100 sites, but Chevron won't say where. These newly approved toxic chemicals are expected to last a long time in nature and accumulate in living things. Oregon U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley chairs the Senate Subcommittee on Environmental Justice and Chemical Safety. He wrote in a letter to the EPA earlier this year, quote, "So-called chemical recycling has been touted by companies like Chevron as a way to reduce plastic waste through repurposing it, but turning plastic waste into fuel increases greenhouse gas emissions, subsidizes the petrochemical industry, and harms frontline communities located near these facilities. While it is urgent that our country takes action to address climate chaos, we need to ensure that the steps we take actually reduce greenhouse gas emissions and do not do so by sacrificing historically marginalized communities and those who are already overburdened by toxic pollution," end quote. According to the EPA, Chevron has not started making the new fuels yet. For KBOO News, I'm Grant Button.
Supporters of the Crisis Response Program, Portland Street Response, delivered a petition to City Council with 11,000 signatures this week. Portland Street Response was built to respond to low-level behavioral and mental health calls that normally would go to the police. Instead, they send out teams of paramedics and mental health specialists to help people in crisis. Friends of Portland Street Response urge the council to preserve funding and resources for the fledgling response program after 6 months of setbacks. Street Response is housed within the Fire Bureau, which is under control of City Commissioner Rene Gonzalez. After Gonzalez took office this year, he ordered Street Response to stop giving out tents and tarps just before the worst snowstorm in years. He also ordered Street Response workers to respond to homeless camp sweeps, something workers felt was contradictory to their mission. In June, Interim Fire Chief Ryan Gillespie froze the hiring and purchasing of Street Response. Gillespie cited compliance issues and budget constraints as the rationale. That hiring freeze was lifted a few weeks ago.
Staffing and leadership at Portland Street Response has also been an ongoing issue, with 9 employees resigning or getting fired between February and May of this year. Program manager Robin Burrick resigned in July and said in an exit interview that she felt, quote, set up and politically scapegoated. Lila Layton is the incoming Portland Street Response Program Manager. She wrote in a memo to staff late last month, quote, I want to acknowledge that being clear about the very real limits of our response model creates the opportunity to build the best possible version of Portland Street Response, a program with a specific mission and scope that works synergistically along a broader continuum of care in our community. Commissioner Gonzalez pitched Multnomah County on funding the program through the Joint Office of Homeless Services, but it was late additions and without support from the mayor. It's also a point of contention for Portland Street Response workers that the city sees them as a homeless responder as opposed to mental health crisis responders. The petition urges the city to establish Portland Street Response as its own independent branch of the First Responder Network and keep the program separate from homeless sweep enforcement. Late last year, the program was on track to be operating 24/7. Currently, their hours are 8 a.m. to 10 p.m.
Former President Donald Trump pleads not guilty to charges in the latest indictment. Clean election advocates in Maine want to ban foreign government spending in state elections, and Florida has banned AP psychology due to topics of sexual orientation and gender identity. With more on the story, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
In these indictments, the justice system is working as it should.
Lisa Gilbert with the nonprofit consumer advocacy organization Public Citizen said in order to protect the integrity of the United States democracy, it's essential that former President Donald Trump's case proceed like any other. In his latest indictment, Trump is being charged in connection with his alleged attempts to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election. On Thursday, Trump pleaded not guilty to all charges, and his lawyer claims the indictment is a form of election interference.
We will never give up. We will never concede. It doesn't happen. You don't concede when there's theft involved.
Trump will be in court again on August 28th. In the 45-page indictment, the Department of Justice alleges Trump led a dishonest and fraudulent effort to stay in power after losing the presidential election to Joe Biden in 2020. On Wednesday, former Attorney General Bill Barr appeared on CNN and said he sees no legal issues with the indictment and doesn't see the move as an abuse of power by the DOJ.
Department of Justice is not acting to weaponize the department by proceeding against the president for a conspiracy to subvert the electoral process.
Advocates for clean elections in Maine are gearing up for a November ballot referendum that would ban foreign government spending in state elections. The Maine legislature recently passed a bill to enact a ban, but it was vetoed by Governor Janet Mills, who said the bill's language raised First Amendment concerns. Caitlin LaCaze with Protect Maine Elections says the ban makes sense to voters.
Our opponents will have tens of millions of dollars.
Companies from Canada and Spain are already spending some of that money on statewide TV ads opposing a public takeover of two New England-based power companies. On Thursday, Fitch Ratings, a credit rating agency, downgraded the United States' credit rating in part due to how the federal government handled the debt crisis approximately 2 months ago. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen called the move unwarranted.
Fitch's decision is puzzling in light of the economic strength we see in the United States.
Yellen said Fitch's move does not change what already is known. She said Treasury securities remain the world's preeminent safe and liquid asset, and that the American economy is fundamentally strong. Finally, Florida has now effectively banned advanced placement psychology classes. The College Board said it's due to the course's content on sexual orientation and gender identity. The state's Department of Education notified the College Board that the AP course is in violation of state law. I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our HRS indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sona Lee. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Your weather forecast are beautiful but all too short. Pacific Northwest summer continues, partly cloudy and 60 overnight tomorrow. A few clouds in the sunny skies with a high of 85. Today in history, in 1693, is the date traditionally ascribed to Dom Perignon's invention of champagne. It's not clear whether he actually invented champagne, but he's been credited as an innovator who developed the techniques to use to perfect sparkling wine. The quote of the day is from American trumpeter and influential jazz musician Louis Armstrong, who was born this day in 1901. He said, quote, "There are two kinds of music, the good and the bad. I play the good kind."
The Interior Secretary's Road to Healing Tour holds two events in California this week. Secretary Deb Haaland is traveling the country to learn more about the federal Indian boarding school experience. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The U.S. Interior Secretary's year-long listening tour to learn more about the federal Indian boarding school experience travels to California. As part of their Road to Healing journey, Secretary Deb Haaland and Assistant Secretary Brian Newland will visit Riverside Friday and Rohnert Park Sunday. Newland says he's been to a lot of the sessions, but always learned something new from boarding school survivors and their families.
Many of them are elders now, and I try to, as they're speaking about their experiences, picture them as little kids when these things were done to them. And it really humanizes this story in a way that's painful but necessary.
The listening sessions are part of the Federal Indian Boarding School Initiative, a comprehensive effort to look at the troubled legacy of policies that tried to systematically assimilate children by altering their identities in a militaristic way.
It's more than statistics. It's more than a policy. It's more than a law or a Supreme Court case. At the end of the day, these were kids in these boarding schools.
The sessions not only document the physical and emotional abuse they endured, but also attempt to start a healing process. Trauma-informed support is offered at each gathering. Another goal is to develop new programs to revitalize tribal languages and culture to counteract nearly two centuries of policies aimed at their destruction. Blackfeet educator and leader Earl Barlow died last week at the age of 96. Montana Public Radio's Austin Amestoy has this remembrance.
Barlow became known as the father of Indian education in Montana for his efforts to recognize the tribes during the state's 1972 Constitutional Convention. In a 2007 interview with the Regional Learning Project, Barlow recounted part of his address to the convention's delegates after he read a newspaper article that contained racist stereotypes about Native Americans.
Is bigotry in the state of Montana a real concern? If it is, then you the delegates have a golden opportunity to strike a blow for tolerance by incorporating into this Constitution words to that effect.
Despite there being no Native American delegates, Barlow's advocacy led to the constitutional creation of the Indian Education for All program. Barlow was born in 1927 and raised on the Blackfeet Reservation. After serving in World War II, he returned to Montana and began a long career in education. In 1970, he became the first American Indian to serve as supervisor of Indian education within Montana's Office of Public Instruction. State Democratic Senator Susan Weber attended Browning High School when Barlow was its superintendent. She said Barlow broke down barriers for indigenous people in Montana and encouraged Native American girls to pursue their dreams in a time when that sentiment wasn't popular.
They never said that you could be a Montana state senator, you know. That came a long way, and he was the first to show us the way.
Each June 2nd since 2019, the state of Montana has recognized Earl Barlow Day in honor of his lifetime commitment to Indian education and indigenous rights. For National Native News, I'm Austin Amestoy.
The Cherokee Nation has partnered with the University of Tulsa's Oklahoma Center for the Humanities to share the story of Cherokee freedmen and explore the tribe's history with Black slavery. We are Cherokee, Cherokee freedmen, and the right to citizenship details the fight Cherokee freedmen went through to get their Cherokee Nation citizenship back. The Cherokee Nation says the exhibit serves as a tribute to the enduring spirit of freedmen and reaffirms the tribe's commitment to reconciliation. The exhibit opens Friday and will be on display through September 23rd. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The two Tennessee legislators who were expelled from office for protesting for stronger gun control laws won their districts back in a special election yesterday. State Representatives Justin Jones from Nashville and Justin Pearson from Memphis defeated their Republican opponents in landslide victories. The Tennessee House voted to expel the pair after they took to the chamber floor in April to demand gun control legislation after a deadly mass shooting in Nashville. Republicans said it was a breach of decorum and voted for the two to be expelled. They were reappointed on an interim basis by their respective counties. Tennessee Governor Bill Lee has called a special session starting August 12th to address gun violence.
Nearly three-quarters of America's youth see gun violence as a problem, and a majority want stricter gun laws. Those figures come from a new study from American University. This may be because young adults grew up in an era where mass shootings and particularly school shootings were common. KBOO's Grant Button reports.
Some 74% of young people in the U.S. believe gun violence is a problem, and almost 60% want to see stricter gun laws. That's according to a new report from American University, the Everytown for Gun Safety and the Southern Poverty Law Center. Researchers pulled a nationally representative sample of more than 4,100 people ages 14 to 30. Wyatt Russell with American University says this generation, raised in an era where mass shootings are common, says school safety is a major concern and is associated with negative mental health outcomes.
The average young person knows at least one other person who's been injured or killed by a gun. We've seen an astonishingly high 25% of youth have been in an active shooter lockdown, not a drill, a lockdown.
A study from the Kaiser Family Foundation also found that gun violence was a leading cause of death for kids in 2020 and 2021, more than any other type of illness or injury, the highest rate among large, wealthy nations. Opponents of stricter gun laws cite concerns about personal freedom and self-defense. Russell notes the survey found that a young person's access to guns, identification with gun culture, and exposure to media relating to guns correlated with support for male supremacy, belief that the Second Amendment gives individuals the right to overthrow the government, higher levels of racial resentment, and post-traumatic stress disorders.
We're working to develop some inoculation strategies to help young people stop harmful mis- and disinformation, conspiratorial thinking, and supremacist ideologies that can influence gun violence, more specifically extremist violence as well.
40% of young people in the survey said they have somewhat easy access to a gun, and 21% reported having very easy access. For KBOO News and the Public News Service, I'm Grant Bunn.
A community walk in Bellingham, Washington this Sunday will acknowledge the death of a farm worker in the community 6 years ago. It also marks the 78th anniversary of the Hiroshima bombing. Eric Tegedoff has more on that story.
An event is being held this weekend to honor a farm worker who died on the job in Bellingham. It also coincides with the anniversary of the dropping of an atomic bomb on Hiroshima. Walking Together in Remembrance takes place on Sunday to recognize the passing in 2017 of Ernesto Silva Ibarra, a 28-year-old farm worker who collapsed from heat stress at work. Jason McGill is head of Northwest Youth Services, which fights youth homelessness in the community.
This walk is to remind all of us that we will not forget and we will continue to advocate for what is right for all.
The walking tour will begin at 10 a.m. at the Bellingham Theater Guild. The event is hosted by Community 2 Community Development, a grassroots organization that fights for immigrant and farm workers' rights. They will highlight the need for more farm worker protections as the climate crisis worsens. Sunday is the 78th anniversary of the United States dropping of an atomic bomb on Hiroshima. Before the bombing, Japanese Americans in Bellingham and along the West Coast were moved to concentration camps. McGill notes that Bellingham has a troubling past, including one of the oldest KKK chapters in Washington.
You only hear the positives about how progressive this community is, but this area has a really strong racist history.
The event will also mark the removal of indigenous people in the region from their traditional fishing sites. McGill is speaking at the event and will talk about his organization's opposition to a measure on the November ballot to build a new jail in the community. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Casey Fair becomes the youngest World Cup player ever at only 16 years old. The college football conference, the Pac-12, is in trouble as Oregon and Washington leave, and Diana Taurasi scores her 10,000th point. Grant Button has more with sports news.
Do you remember what you were doing between your sophomore and junior year of high school? Well, sure hope Casey Fair does, as she became the youngest player to ever play in a World Cup match at only 16 years old. On July 25th, Fair was subbed into the game for South Korea in the 78th minute. Initially feeling butterflies in her stomach, I mean, how could you not, she quickly went into autopilot. She also came off the bench for 8 minutes at the end of the game against Morocco when South Korea was chasing a goal. She said, quote, "I think it shows that if you work hard from a young age, no matter how old you are, if you can work hard, you get to the biggest stage," end quote. After her first match, she posted on her Instagram, quote, "This is just the beginning," end quote. Speaking of football, American football, the Pac-12 conference for college football is slowly becoming dismantled as teams continue to leave the conference. This is because the Pac-12's current media rights deal has expired, causing the conference to lose two massive money-making schools in USC and UCLA. Today, the universities of Oregon and Washington are finalizing a deal to join the Big Ten Conference, now the Big 18 Conference. This puts the over century-old Pac-12 in a whole heap load of trouble as teams keep leaving, with Arizona expecting to join the Big Ten after finalizing a deal. This sets a precedent moving forward of building super conferences, leading way to a whole new layout of college football. Goodbye, Pac-12. We will miss you. Speaking of setting precedents, Phoenix Mercury veteran Diana Taurasi became the first WNBA player to reach 10,000 career points at 41 years old. She did so in front of a home crowd in Phoenix, scoring 42 points, the most she's had in a game since 2010. She became the oldest player in WNBA history to score 40 as well. Taurasi became the WNBA's scoring leader in June of 2017, when she surpassed Tina Thompson's measly, in comparison, 7,488 points. She has only been a part of the Mercury, leading them to 3 WNBA championships and won 1 league MVP in 2009. She says, quote, "When you are in a place for 20 years, you get to see everything. You get to see the highs of the highs, which I've been to, and I've been to the lows of the lows. There's something to be said about going through all these stages with the one team. You learn a lot about yourself when you are in these situations," end quote. Goat talk. For KBOO Sports News, I'm Grant Bunn.
Community solar programs can make green energy more accessible to everyone. Subscribers to a community solar program essentially purchase a share of a solar farm. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on that story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections.
Going solar can lower people's monthly utility bills. But not everyone can install solar panels on their homes. Many people are renters, and lots of people who do own their homes cannot afford the upfront cost of an installation.
How do they also gain benefits from this clean energy transition? So that's where community solar comes in.
Utopia Hill is the CEO of Reactivate, a renewable energy company that develops community solar projects. Subscribers to Community Solar essentially purchase a share of a solar farm and receive clean energy credits on their utility bill to offset the cost of their electricity use. Because of Illinois state incentives, Hill's company was recently able to develop three community solar projects that are specifically designed for low and middle income Illinois residents.
It doesn't require a credit score. It doesn't require a contract. There are no termination fees.
And subscribers can save up to 50% on the electricity supply portion of their utility bills. So it's a model for getting more solar energy on the grid, while also making sure that lower income people can get the financial benefits of clean energy. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, August 4th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Grant Button. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Laura Miller. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Eric Tegedoff, and Alex Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is the always busy Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM,